So, good morning, Professor Orlan. Thank you very much for joining us. As we were just discussing, the main purpose of this interview is to discuss the genesis of ideas behind replica symmetry breaking from roughly 1975 to 1995. But before we get to the core of the topic, we'd like to get a few questions on background. And Peter, can you tell us a bit more about your family and your studies before you started university?
What do you mean, my family?
Well, what context or what led you to pursue studies in physics in particular?
Okay, so when I was young, I was quite interested in physics, chemistry, and playing with engineering kind of stuff. And then when I grew up, I was more interested in mathematics. So I went to class préparatoire in mathematics. And then I went to École Normale Supérieure de Saint-Cloud, which is now the École Normale Supérieure de Lyon. And I took the math concours, the math way. But as soon as I got in, I decided to switch to physics, because I was fascinated by the mathematics of quantum mechanics, which I found quite amazing and extremely beautiful. So I switched to physics. So I did my studies in physics, and then when I started my PhD, I started in nuclear physics and quantum many-body theory. And rapidly I started to work. So I did my PhD in Saclay, in the lab where I'm still now. That was in I started in 76. And very soon I started to work on the functional integral representations of the many-body problem. So many-body problem, it's for fermions, so it's path integrals in terms of Grassmann variables. And at that time, it turns out that Cyrano de Dominicis was working on this problem of counting the number of solution of the TAP equation, the Thouless-Anderson-Palmer equations, which are kind of sophisticated or mean field equations for the which are exact for the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model. So they go beyond the normal mean field at order 1 over n. And to do that, he was using a formalism where you express you count the number of solutions by introducing a delta function which is normalized by a determinant, as you know. And his calculation, when there is a determinant, that was involving some Grassmann variables. And Cyrano didn't know much about Grassmann variables, so he came to see me because I was working on this problem for many-body physics, for quantum many-body physics fermion systems. And we started collaborating with him, and there was also Thomas Garrel and Marc Gabay. And we started working on this problem of counting the solutions of the TAP equations, and actually they in the beginning they were making a mistake, and when we did the calculations correctly, we realized that there was an exponentially large number of solutions to these TAP equations. So that was the beginning of my interest and my switching from quantum many body to statistical physics and to classical statistical physics, actually.
So, had you heard of spinning glasses before then, or
No,
that
absolutely
was your
not.
introduction?
No, that was the introduction. I didn't know what was a quenched disorder. I learned about quenched disorder, about all this nice stuff. And I found it quite fascinating that by taking the log of the partition function and averaging the log of the partition function, you can describe the two kinds of relaxation times in the system, the very slow relaxation times of the impurities and the fast relaxation time, which leads to equilibrium of the spin variables, or in other cases of other variables. And that was quite a discovery for me. This was the, I think, introduced by Braut and Englert if I am not mistaken, this quenched averaging procedure. And we started to work with Cyrano, and I worked with, and actually I finished my PhD. So I did half of my PhD in quantum many body theory and the other half with Cyrano on spin glass problems and disordered problem.
So I think that that Marc Gabet, Thomas Garel, and you were all at ENS Saint-Cloud.
Absolutely.
So you were a pretty close friend with Thomas even, right?
Yes,
so,
I was very good friend with Thomas. We lost track of each other since a few years, since he retired, actually. He left the lab about 6-7 years ago, maybe 7-8 years. He was 1 year ahead of me.
Okay.
1 year older than me.
So did that facilitate the interactions when we were working together on this project?
Sorry?
The fact that you were rather friendly, did that facilitate the interactions?
Can you tell us
a bit how you were working then as a friend / collaborators?
Yes. So at that time, Marc and Thomas were in Orsay, in the Laboratoire de Physique des Solides of Orsay, very famous lab where actually Blandin was... Blandin was, of course, a very central figure in the field of spin glasses. And Thomas and Marc had worked with Blandin. They had done quite interesting work on replicas and on spin glasses with Blandin. And so that's how they started to collaborate with Cyrano. Cyrano came to spin glasses from the dynamics point of view. As you may know, Cyrano was a specialist of critical dynamics. And that's how he came to spin glasses because of this, the fact that an alternative to averaging the disorder was to do the average of time-dependent correlation functions and things like that. So that's how Cyrano came to spin glasses. Of course, then he went to work about replicas. I mean, he gave up on dynamics and went working with replicas. But where was I? Yes, Marc and Thomas used to come to Saclay, and we used to work here. And one anecdote that I can tell you is that we used to have extremely big formulas. There is an amphitheater in Saclay, which is the Amphi Block, which has very big blackboards, very, very big. So we used to work very often in this amphitheater so that we could cover, write formulas which would extend over the whole blackboard. And then, of course, we would go to lunch. And I remember one day the cleaning lady wiped out everything we had written, and Cyrano was completely mad. And so we had to post all the work of the morning. But it was very... very handy to have these big blackboards and to be able to write these long formulas on the blackboard. So it was a very, very friendly atmosphere, very nice, and we are very good friends, and that was very pleasant.
And very collaborative in the sense that you would all do the same work in parallel, or would you break down the problem into...
No, we would work together on the blackboard,
okay.
All the four of us. We would, one after the other, I mean, depending who would, and then, of course, we would redo the calculation individually to make sure that there was no mistake, and that's how it, yes.
And I wanted to ask you a question. So who was your supervisor for the fermion part, and there any interaction between the two? I mean, besides the Grassmann variables that were common to the two?
No. So my first supervisor was Richard Schaeffer, who was a nuclear physicist. He's still a nuclear physicist. Well, who switched to astrophysics and cosmology. And actually, I didn't want to follow him into this field, although we have one paper on this subject in astrophysics. But in 1979 or so, I started my thesis in 76 in those days, a thesis was 5-6 years. It was not, it's only later that the thesis was restricted to 3 years. So in that time, it was called the test data, and it was 5-6 years typically. And so in the middle, after about 3 years, so I started in 76, and in 79, Richard Schaeffer decided to switch to astrophysics. And I was not, I was always more interested in quantum many body statistical physics. So it turns out that at that time, precisely, I had this interaction with Cyrano. So I decided to continue with Cyrano on problems of disorder and related problems.
But the quantum part was not there.
Sorry?
The quantum aspect was not there at that time.
No, no.
Yeah. And can I ask you another thing? So the you mentioned that Cyrano came to spin glasses because of the dynamics, and I know his paper on the dynamical averages as a substitute for replicas. So why? I mean, what was at the time the so in the early 80s? What was the perception of this interplay between dynamics and replicas, and why Cyrano decided to give up dynamics to concentrate on replicas?
Well, I think because of well, in some sense, you know, the way to calculate the, so you know, Cyrano was a specialist of using the Martin Cijaro's formalism for dynamics. And in the Martin Cijaro's formalism, essentially you constrain by a delta function, you constrain the equation of motion, the Langevin equation, and then you have a Jacobian, which is essentially the determinant of the derivative of the equation. And then, so he decided in some sense, he applied this kind of formalism to calculate the solutions of the TAP equations, of the TAP equations, by using exactly the same formalism, except that there is no time. There was no time. And I think, so started to work on this, and then we realized that that the number of solutions of this equation was exponentially large. And that's how I think he started to come to replicas and replica symmetry breaking and these kind of things. And it seemed to be more better adapted to tackle the problem than dynamics, because of course there was Sompolinski who was working on the dynamics. Sompolinski, Annette Zippelius, I don't know if you they had been working on that, and then there was a nice paper by Chaim Sompolinski alone where he introduced and give an interpretation of the replica symmetry breaking in terms of dynamics. Of,
So, speaking of which, you actually wrote, I think the following paper you wrote with Thomas Garel was about the Sompolinski functional.
Yeah, that was with Marc Gabbé, I think, and Thomas, no?
Sorry, Marc Gabbé, you're right, my mistake.
I'm putting up the paper because, as you may imagine, I'm, to tell you the truth, I've forgotten a lot of what is in this, what's in these papers.
It's a replica derivation of some Sompolinski free energy functional for mean field spin glasses.
So you know that when you do dynamics, there are two kind of order parameters which appear. One is a correlation function, one is a response function. And so the idea was to try to introduce, so, and the idea was to try to introduce replica symmetry breaking, which would introduce two types of functions also, one more or less related to correlation, one to linear response or something like that. That's what I remember. So we had a scheme for, unfortunately, I should,
So
in I should have prepared better this interview and went back. We're talking about a paper from 81. Yeah. Oh, actually, August 28, 81. So it's over 40 years ago. So
you then left for MIT, right? For, I think, yes. It was a postdoc position. Is that correct?
Actually, I was assistant professor.
So it was a tenure track position at MIT?
No.
Okay. It was a visiting
assistant professor.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. And, I had already my position in Saclay in that time. Yes.
So during your time in Cambridge, did you interact at all with Sampolinski and others from the Halprin group?
No, so we discussed a lot, but not really interacted. I was teaching a course, I was teaching several courses at MIT I was teaching one course per semester. I stayed for 2 years. So I taught a course on quantum antibody, and I taught a course on disordered system. And in this course on disordered system, I was teaching spin glasses in part. I was teaching quite a few topics. But I was teaching spin glasses and replicas and replica symmetry breaking. And I had quite amazing students that, so Kardar, Mehran Kardar was a student at that time, was a graduate student. I'm talking about him because he later used replicas and things like that. I had David Andelman, etc. So I was discussing with Sampolinski, and also at MIT, I was discussing with Nihat Berker, who was a good friend of mine, and he was telling me, you know, he was doing this work on Migdal-Kadanoff renormalization of frustrated systems and chaotic trajectories, and this paper with his student Susan McKay, Susan McKay, and maybe Kirkpatrick, or I don't remember exactly. You know the paper.
Mm-hmm. So during your interactions with Sampolinski and maybe others in the Halprin group at that time, did you get into any insight into their reaction to the ideas of replica symmetry breaking and how it was being received? And
tell you, yes, I think, yes. Okay. Not only that, but I saw also a seminar by Anderson at that time. So that was 81, 82. And everybody was convinced that it was exact, that it was the solution of the problem. And it was obvious to everybody that this was the solution, but nobody knew how to prove it, of course. But that was the general consensus that this is the solution. And of course, nobody understood the mathematics, the derivation. I mean, everybody saw the steps, and there was some logic in the steps, but nobody could justify anything of it.
So after that, you largely left the field for a few years. And except for, you had a paper with Cyrano and one of his thesis students, François Lenné.
Actually, François Lenné was a student of Jean-Zim Justin.
Oh, okay, I see.
Yes.
So what led to that work then, and you getting back into spin glass ideas?
It was a paper by Mézard and... I don't remember exactly which paper, where they showed that the distribution of the tail of the lowest lying states was exponential, and that there was a dominant state which was exponentially rare and things like that. And then we had the idea, why not try to do a kind of master equation with a distribution of energies which would mimic somehow the low part of the energy spectrum of a spin glass and see what does it give for the dynamics. So that was the idea. And at that time I was working on master equation dynamics and things like that. Yes.
So from Saclay, you had, a pretty good perspective on the community of spin glasses at that time. Can you tell us a bit how it was working? Who was interacting with whom and what was?
Yes. So we had, as a frequent visitor, we had Mike Moore and Alan Bray. But the more, I think Mike Moore was here more often. And he was funny, very funny guy. And we were having a good time. He was joking all the time. And Cyrano was a great calculator. And Cyrano, you could calculate anything, as you can see in his papers with his with the replicants and all these things. And of course, this virtuosity and this fact that Cyrano was not afraid to take on any calculation was funny for us, that he could do anything, and especially to Mike Moore, who was, it was really admiration, the fact that he was like, he could do anything, like a bulldozer solving all these, doing all this algebra. He was using, I remember he was using these old computer rolls, old computer paper, you know, big, very, and he was writing with a pencil, and when he was doing this replica symmetry breaking stability analysis. And so we had a lot of visits from Mike Moore. Then we had also Amit, Daniel Amit used to come, but that was a bit before, but he used to come quite often to Saclay also. He was on sabbatical in Saclay in the late 70s, so before the spin glasses, but I think that's his stay in Saclay probably triggered, and Sampolinski also came to Saclay, by the way. That probably triggered their interest in neural networks and their analysis of neural networks with the capacity, you know, the transition from associative memory to spin glass phase. Probably they were, I wouldn't say inspired, but it was part of the ideas that they might have gotten interested in. Because Daniel Amit was not working really on spin glasses, but he was very good friend with he loved to talk with Cyrano.
So it was part of the social network. So these are contacts that they established in Saclay and persisted beyond their visits.
Exactly. Yes. So good friend also used to came quite a few times. Somers quite often. And then we had, of course, Toulouse was coming. Toulouse was working a lot with Roger Balian, and there was and Brezin was here, by the way, at that time. Edouard Brezin was still in Saclay till I would think about 84, 85. Derrida, of course, was here in Saclay. And Derrida came out with the random energy model, which was quite amazing. It's really quite an achievement. I mean, such a simple model, and it has so much physics and so much insight into the spin glass model somehow. I remember 1 year. So I couldn't tell you in which year, but it was probably around 84, 85. David Gross was on sabbatical here. So he spent half of his sabbatical here in Saclay, half of his sabbatical in ENS in Paris. And I think, so he had discussions with Cyrano and so, and that's when they did their work on the Potts model, and was it the Potts model? You know, there is a famous paper.
Yes, they have the one, the Gross-Mézard.
The Gross-Mézard, yes, exactly. Who else was there? Okay, and then next door to us, So, you know, in Saclay, there is a next door experimental lab, the SPEC, Service de Physique de l'État Condensé. And there was a big group working on spin glasses, Eric Vincent, Roger Hamann, okay, some people. And they were having visitors like Ray Auerbach, who was from, I think he was in Riverside, right?
UCLA.
Is it UCLA? But he became dean or pro or president of a different UC. Maybe. Yes, at that time he was at UCLA, but then he became
What about Elizabeth Gardner?
Elizabeth Gardner.
Was there, yes. Did you interact? I mean, because at the time she was working on replica solutions for,
yes.
for
actually not only that. So Elizabeth, I couldn't put a year on that, probably in 85, 86. So she came to Saclay as a postdoc of Claudie Dixon. And actually she shared my office for at least 1 year, maybe two. So she was extremely shy, extremely modest, extremely shy. She was, and she was, so initially she was not supposed to work on this, but for some reason she started to, so I talked, we discussed quite a lot because she was in my office. And although she was shy, she ended up talking. And I think she started collaborating with Bernard Derrida at that time. And that's how she got involved by all these discussions. She got involved in the, less in spin glasses than in neural networks and all these models. And that she did.
But she also has a paper on the replica instability in spin glasses from,
okay.
from time.
Maybe, okay.
Yeah. So you never, I mean, so you had a lot of discussions?
Yes, we had a lot of discussions because she was, no. She was really peculiar. She was absolutely outstanding, but difficult to interact with. And so she died so young, it was such a tragedy.
Because you were about the same age, right?
Or I'm a bit older than her, I think. At least 4 or 5 years older.
Okay.
And so also Thomas Garel and Marc Gabbé, they were around at the same time.
No. Yes, but they were in Orsay. They were not.
Ah, okay. So that's why they didn't. So they didn't really talk to her.
No. Okay. She was really in Saclay. Bernard Derrida was not at École Normale yet, and so. She discussed a lot with Derrida and with me because I used to take her for lunch, and you know she was extremely shy and lonely. And
Can I ask you one last question on the community at the time? I don't know exactly how to formulate this question because it's something that is a bit confused in my mind, but. So, I mean, at the time, like in the late 70s, early 80s, there were these people that were already quite famous that were working on spin glasses, like Phil Anderson, Taules. And so you mentioned that Anderson was excited by the Parisi solution.
Absolutely.
And I think we have also been told by someone else, now I don't remember who, that also Taules was, by De Almeida. So he told us that also Taules was quite excited about the Parisi solution. But then, and then also Anderson worked a little bit on the application of these ideas of RSB to like optimization problems. But then it seems that something happened at some point and both like Anderson, Taules, all these people, they stopped really working on these ideas and considering these are important ideas, and they kind of became quite cold, I think, with respect to this replica symmetry breaking idea. So do you understand what happened? What was the...
I think they were discouraged by the mathematics because the mathematics was so weird and so unusual that, and nobody had the simplest idea on how to prove this, this scheme, how to prove the Parisi equation, that although they believed that this was the final solution was correct and that probably the equation was correct, but people were a bit afraid, I think, to use it or to do this kind of of algebraic manipulations.
So this is why you think the
that's why the
French and the Italian school maybe pushed this a bit more, because it was more like the training was more like oriented towards mathematics and things.
That's my feeling that most Americans didn't touch the replica symmetry breaking.
So when you
went, they stayed away. Sorry.
So when you went to teach these ideas in the MIT, the students were like, what was the reaction of the students?
They like the formalism. They like the way it is. Look, the formalism is beautiful. Although you cannot justify. I mean, you can hand wave to justify it, but the formalism is quite beautiful. It's quite appealing, and the final equation that you get is very nice. And so I think it was the first time, of course, nobody was teaching this at that time. So I as a young assistant professor, I was given the possibility to teach anything I wanted. So I gave a course on disordered systems, so on percolation, polymers, spin glasses, all whatever. First of all, I was having fun because it was nice, and people were, I think they were very interested. Yeah. And you know, so shortly after, maybe 1 or 2 years after, Kardar came with his paper about polymer in random media, which he solved by using replicas. And using the Bethe ansatz, and then you know when you use replicas for this problem, you have a quantum many-body problem, quantum mechanics with n equals zero, with a delta interaction, which you can solve exactly. And by getting the ground state, you could get the exact energy of this model, which is which you can map to a Berger's equation and all these things. And he got the exact result of the ground state energy and the corrections by using this replica method, and the solution of the Bethe ansatz for delta, which I was teaching in my quantum many-body course.
Okay, so
he did a nice synthesis.
A few years later, you worked again on spin glasses in the context of protein folding. At this point,
yes, exactly. So.
Yeah, can you walk us through what led to that for you?
Okay, so I got interested in protein folding when I was at MIT, actually, about because protein foldings looked very much like you have a sequence of amino acid, which is of course not random, but to first approximation, you could imagine that it's a quenched random sequence, and you can ask if you put so you know that in these proteins you have amino acids, so you have residues which can attract, some are repulsive. So the most schematic model that you could imagine is just to imagine that you have a random sequence with random interaction between the various residues. And so that's how we came to this problem. And of course, we used the formalism of replicas, but then it's of course much more complicated because you have a chain which connects everything, so it's more complicated. But that was that's what led us to this problem. So the first paper that we did was on this. We use a random interaction between pairs. And that was, our first work. And then we thought, but after all, there is a sequence. So it's more like you have a random, it's more like a random field model somehow, where you have a sequence of amino acids. And then the random interaction, there is an interaction depending on the amino acid. On the sequence, right? So if you have 20 types of amino acid, you would have 20 times 9, okay, 190 type of interaction or something like that. Whereas in the spin glass model, there is not really sequence. You any pair ij will have a specific interaction. So if you have the same amino acid ij in some different place, they will have a different interaction in the spin glass model. So actually, we thought that we corrected our initial spin glass model by more like a random field model.
So what was the relationship between spin glass ideas and protein folding at that time? In particular, your work was following that of Peter Wolness a year before, right?
Yes. So that was what triggered this idea. The work of Wolness and what's the name of
Brandwine.
Sorry?
Brandwine or Brangewein?
Yes, Bringelson. Bringelson.
Oh, sorry.
Yes, Bringelson. So so it is well known, it was known experimentally that in proteins, you have some kind of a freezing of lateral chains and freezing of certain sequences, and that you have to be extremely careful when you cool them down to fold them, especially complex proteins, not the smaller one, but bigger one, because they can get trapped in various minima and things like that. And so from this consideration, Wolness came out with the idea that after all, you can describe. So when you have a freezing transition, you think about the random energy model. So he made a so-called random energy model for protein folding, which was really very phenomenological, and which was just to say that the system makes transition between various the random states are correspond to the various conformations of the protein in the folding process, and that the system will when you look at the random energy model, you have this the density of state, which has the shape of an inverted parabola, and when you write the temperature is the tangent to the parabola, and when it hits at some point the slope of the tangent hits the, when it comes to the bottom of the, to the intersection of the parabola with the real axis, then you have a freezing transition. So Wolness and Bringelson used these ideas to try to describe in a phenomenological way the folding, the protein folding problem, namely what is random are the different contacts between the various amino acids during the in the folding process. So that's how we got the idea that in this model there was no chain, no polymer. So we thought with Thomas, can we imagine a polymer model which will precisely go in the direction of this, and we will be a microscopic model which will have some of the characteristics of this random energy model, and which will describe this freezing transition. So that's how we came to this model of, and of course the most natural idea was to take a chain and imagine that you have random interactions between any pairs of amino acids, which we refined afterwards with making it more random field like because of the sequence. Yeah, that was the idea. I forgot. You see, you are reminding me the history. I forgot that all this was triggered by the Wolness Bringelson paper.
And this was by reading the paper or talking?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Reading.
Any interactions with Wolness, Peter Wolness, or?
Wolness, I met later. I met in 92, I think, in Santa Barbara, okay. At a meeting, at a session in Santa Barbara, we were together at that time. Yes. That's also where I met Dave Tirumalai. Yes.
So you largely left the field of spin glasses or even spin glass related applications after that work. Did you nevertheless follow the development of the field beyond?
A little bit with optimization problem. I've been always interested in optimization and its relation to spin glasses. Actually, I wrote a paper in 84, 85 about the traveling salesman problem and the assignment problem. But you know, where you have an infinite number of order parameters, but I did it with no replica symmetry breaking because it was already so complicated because you have this infinity of order parameters. And actually, our paper came out at the same time as my paper came out at the same, in the same, it's together with the paper of Mézard and Parisi on the same problem, where they calculate this famous pi square over six. Right. You know, the sum, when you take the assignment problem, the bipartite matching problem, when you take the weights to be exponentially distributed, they could solve the mean field equation exactly, and they got that the ground state cost or ground state energy was pi square over six, which was very beautiful and which was confirmed afterwards to be exact.
So I mean, so you left the field, but how influential was your work on spinning glasses on other problems that you've tackled beyond that, or other aspects of your research or administrative careers beyond that?
Well, I've used replicas many times in many contexts, many different other problems, for instance, I've been working in soft matter. And in soft matter, for instance, I did some work on random heteropolymers, the conformations of random heteropolymers. So there it's really, and there I use replicas. But since I'm a bit lazy, I usually like to use replica symmetry solutions. But in some cases, one should use replica symmetry breaking. But then when the problems are more complex than just the pure Sherrington Kirkpatrick model, replica symmetry breaking can really be messy and complicated, especially if you have more than one order parameter, then it's a total mess, big mess.
So it's remained with you essentially throughout your career. You've used ideas.
Yes. Actually, we did one paper with Cyrano and one of his Hungarian collaborator, Temesvari, mm-hmm. on the random fieldizing model, where we found a spin glass phase which apparently cannot exist. I think Len Kazdebrova showed later that this spin glass phase cannot exist by very general principle inequalities. She showed me that when she arrived in the lab.
So you mentioned a class you taught at MIT on which you retouched on spin glasses. Have you ever taught other classes, or did you reuse this material in other classes?
Yes, I taught that at the Weizmann Institute in where I was visiting professor in 87. Then I taught it at ENS in one of these specialized courses in 90 or 92. I think that was it. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Is there anything else you would like to share with us about this era that we may have overlooked?
What can I say? No, it was very exciting, of course, because it was so new and so weird somehow, so unusual, this mathematics. And what was really amazing is the simplicity of the model, of the SK model, and the fact that one has to go through all these weird mathematics to solve it. That was really something fascinating until, of course, the exact solution came out and showed that all this was exact. There is somebody, I think, in the field which has been a bit underestimated, which is André Blandin, who was quite influential, I think, on many people, and especially in the idea of replica symmetry breaking and all these things.
Did you know him? Did you interact with him in those years? Or
a little bit, yes. I had him as a teacher when I was a student. He was teaching hydrodynamics. He was a bit messy as a teacher, but very inspiring. And so that was for hydrodynamics. And then I had a few discussions with him on spin glasses, but never collaborated really. And I had a lot of indirect thoughts of him through Thomas Garrel and Marc Gabay. But I didn't work directly with him. Yes.
But so he was influential in what sense then?
Yeah. In the sense that I think he, well, if I remember correctly, he had a replica symmetry breaking scheme, which was essentially equivalent to the one-step replica symmetry breaking that Parisi would devise later. I mean, Parisi went up to the end, but the first step of the RSB was really the same as the one Blandin had devised a couple of years before. And okay, I don't know if this is okay. In that sense, it was.
And you knew of this work because he had presented it, or this is a retrospective perspective on?
No. When he presented it, all these schemes, all these replica symmetry breaking scheme, to me, they seemed quite artificial. I mean, why do this and not? There was no physical interpretation behind it. It was just looking for the solution of these equations that would be better than no replica symmetry breaking. So it was somehow a curiosity. I think Blandin probably had more insight in it from when you read his paper. I remember reading his paper at that time. It's not very clear why he does it, but apparently he had some insight which I didn't have at that time. And it was an interesting paper that.
There is actually a paper that I mean we discovered while doing these interviews, which is a kind of review that Blandin wrote.
Exactly. Yes.
Is this very beautiful idea, I think, very physical idea of obtaining the Edward Sanderson order parameter by coupling to replicas.
Exactly. Yes.
And then it leads once you introduce additional.
You have all these other parameters, intra-replica, inter-replica, and these things like that. Yes, I remember this paper. Mm-hmm.
So this,
I think, like two replicas. It's like two real replicas almost.
Yes, exactly. So it really contains the. Yes. I mean, at an embryonic stage, but it contains the physics of the of the.
But at that time, it was difficult to understand what was the motivation. Why do this? Why not do that? And it was a very. What else can I tell you about all this? Okay, I would have to. I should. Okay, I'm sorry. I should have prepared it better.
Oh, it's okay. It's okay. I mean,
So, as a final question, do you still have notes, papers, or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have any plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
You see my in the back. At some stage when I will retire, probably I will look through this, and I'm sure I will have some notes about some calculations with the Cyrano or with other things. I don't know what to do with it, but do you think there? My first reaction would be to get rid of all this, okay.
For example, the lecture notes of the course you gave in MIT would be particularly interesting, I think.
I could probably find it.
It seems to be one of the first, probably the first courses that has ever been taught about RSB.
Yes.
In the US, so that could be very interesting.
Yes.
And also if you have like letters or other exchanges with people at the time, this could
with some Polensky or with Cyrano while you were away.
Okay, I will look for that, but I don't know what I kept, you know, from this. My course I may have. I have to.
If you find it, we would be happy to.
Okay.
And in general, I encourage you to consider talking to archivists. I actually don't know how it works in Saclay, but the universities usually have archive mm-hmm. services, and they're in the Paris area. There are ways to get organized.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I will look. I will think about that. Okay. Thanks for the advice. Okay.
Thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you, and thanks.